Thank you, Dean Garland. I'm honored by that warm introduction and just delighted and honored to be here to deliver these parchment lectures. My overall theme is Christian discipleship in contemporary life. And this evening, I want to talk about exegeting the cultures that shape us. As best as I can remember, I heard the word exegesis uttered for the first time when I was in my early teens. And what I clearly remember is that the person who spoke the word then said it in a sneering tone. He was the person who, a visiting revival preacher who was warning us against theological scholars who, he assured us, were bent on undermining the authority of the Bible as the written word of God. They do their best to convince us, he proclaimed, that we ordinary Christian folks cannot understand the Bible's message without the help of their learned methods. They want us, he said, to engage in what they call exegesis. And then came the preacher's rhetorical punchline. I say to those scholars, don't give me exegesis, just give me Jesus. When not too many years after hearing that speaker, I began to be initiated into the world of theological scholarship, I discovered that you don't really have to choose between Jesus and exegesis. To be sure, there are indeed ways of using exegetical tools in the study of the scriptures that can result in undermining the Bible's witness to the person and work of Jesus Christ. But there's also the kind of faithful, God-honoring exegesis that can build us up for pursuing the paths of obedient discipleship. In these lectures, I'm not going to give any sustained attention to the exegesis of specific biblical passages, but I do want to talk about the need for correlating biblical exegesis with exegetical efforts that focus on the larger culture to which we are called to address the claims of the scriptures. What I have in mind here, the need for engaging in a bi-directional exegesis, focusing on both the scriptures and our cultural context, is spelled out nicely in Kosuke Koyama's delightfully titled book, Water Buffalo Theology. There, the late Japanese-American theologian reflected on his experience of being sent early in his career by his Japanese church as a missionary to northern Thailand. Koyama had spent most of his life up to that point in urban settings. And suddenly he found himself in a rural region with many rice paddies. As he rode around the countryside on his motor scooter, he reported, he saw people whose lives involved many days of standing in shallow water alongside a water buffalo. Then these days were followed by a period in which the people had to find some way of staying dry during the onslaught of the monsoon rains. Koyama decided to read the Bible as if he were standing alongside a water buffalo in a rice paddy. When he did so, passages and images leaped out at him that he had never really thought about before. He discovered that there's much in the Bible about water. God rules from a place above the rains and the floods. God stays dry. These themes came to loom large in his presentation of the gospel to the people of that region. In generalizing on the method that he had been using in his efforts to understand what the Bible has to say to the culture of northern Thailand, Koyama observed that the missionary must always be aware of being, and these are his words, sandwiched between Christ's saving reality and the other-than-myself reality of the neighbors to whom the gospel is being addressed. And this requires, Koyama argued, engaging in what he describes as two kinds of exegesis. Exegesis of the Word of God and exegesis of the life and culture of the people among whom the missionary lives and works. This two-way exegesis allows the missionary to take the questions asked in a given cultural context as he puts it, to the enlightenment and judgment of the Word of God. I need to clarify what I'm going to be referring to when I use the word culture in these lectures. The word culture has the same root as cultivate. Thus, agriculture is the culture of the agros, the field. Horticulture is the cultivation of plants, and so on. When we use the word culture to apply to human realities, we're referring to the ways in which we human beings cultivate patterns and processes that give meaning to our collective interactions, as well as the things that we grow as a result of those interactions. Culture is the basic stuff of collective human life: language, entertainment, economic transactions, rituals, the patterns of family life, and much more. All of this is what shapes our daily lives and the lives of the people that we want to reach with the gospel. The importance of paying serious attention to the cultural context has allowed us to appreciate the fact of cultural diversity, both within the Christian community and in the larger human community as such. The theologian who has inspired much that is associated with this perspective is the late Leslie Newbegin, who served for many years as a missionary in India. When Newbegin returned to the British Isles after his retirement, he was shocked by the major cultural changes that had taken place there, as well as on the European continent and in North America. When he had begun his missionary career, he had seen himself as being sent out from a Christian culture to the mission field. But now his own homeland was a mission field. Christians in the West, Newbegin observed, can no longer take a dominant Christian influence for granted. We are now post-Christendom, and the church today, wherever the church is called to serve the Lord, must see itself as a missionary church. Thus, the missional church emphasis that has been receiving much attention of late. To recognize that we now minister in a missionary context in our own culture is to open ourselves to learning from the kinds of missional efforts set forth by Kosuke Koyama. This requires, as I see it, the nurturing of a cultural empathy, an identification with what is so nicely proclaimed in the Christmas carol's celebration of the Savior's birth. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Like the foreign missions movement, when it has been functioning at its best, we're called to exegete the hopes and fears of human beings to whom we want to bring the gospel. This does not mean, of course, that we simply take at face value the ways in which those persons describe their needs. Noted earlier that Koyama's intention in advocating his two-way exegesis was to present the questions that emerge in a given culture to the Word of God for both enlightenment and judgment. We must identify the real nature of those needs by probing beneath the surface of the underlying God-implanted yearnings that give rise to what appears on the surface. There's an illustration that regularly gets attributed to G.K. Chesterton that gets at this point in a provocative manner. It goes like this: the man who knocks on the door of a house of prostitution is looking for God. I discovered recently that no one's been able to find that comment in Chesterton's writings, but it does show up in a piece by a lesser-known author. Wherever the illustration actually comes from, it makes a profound point. Obviously, the statement shouldn't be taken as meaning that the man who approaches the house of prostitution hopes that God will be the one who greets him at the door. The real message is that people who are looking for ultimate fulfillment in the quest for sexual pleasure or wealth or power or any other element or aspect of creation will not find it in any of these things. The Westminster Shorter Catechism puts the point simply: our chief end as human beings is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. Nothing brings genuine fulfillment to the human spirit except an obedient relationship with our Creator. When we think then about the experienced needs of unbelievers in our own day, it's important to recognize that those needs, those quests and longings, are not wrong in themselves. To see this is to affirm a core truth in the seeker-sensitive approach to worship. We need to begin with actual hopes and fears, but we must also acknowledge that these felt yearnings are often misdirected. People who are trapped in sinful lives are looking in the wrong places to find ultimate meaning and true satisfaction. Needless to say, the things that I've been saying here are not uncontroversial. There are many folks in the theological world these days who would express skepticism about my willingness to give some credence to felt needs, to the actual hopes and fears of our fellow human beings. They would insist that those human dispositions are deeply shaped by patterns of culture that are so profoundly misdirected that our only recourse as Christians is to call people to a metanoia, a radical turning around, in order to submit then to an alternative culture that fundamentally reshapes their desires and dispositions. The underlying questions at stake here were addressed at length in H. Richard Niebuhr's 1961 book, Christ and Culture, where Niebuhr, as I'm sure we all know, offered a fivefold typology that offers us some helpful handles in thinking about the relationship between Christian faith and cultural realities. His famous typology, Christ against culture, the Christ of culture, Christ above culture, Christ and culture and paradox, and Christ the transformer of culture, depicts a spectrum of viewpoints regarding the assessment of our so-called natural human yearnings. Does the basic Christian message stand over against those yearnings? Does it give a kind of carte blanche endorsement to those yearnings? Does it see them as constituting a kind of experiential scaffolding for the Bible to build upon our felt hopes and fears? Is it its relationship to those yearnings a paradoxical one, a standing in tension with our felt hopes and fears? Or does the gospel begin with those yearnings in order to transform them? In my own efforts to understand the theological issues in exploring these matters, I've been most helped by testing my own thoughts in interaction with defenders of Anabaptist thought. At the time of the Reformation, the question of what it means for a Christian to be a citizen of a nation and to engage in positive ways in the larger culture, those questions were the subject of passionate debates, especially between Calvinists and Anabaptists. And the debates have continued to our present day. Anabaptist-type themes have been given new life in recent years, particularly because of the influence of Stanley Hauerwas, whose writings have had considerable influence not only among evangelicals who are attracted to the strong Christocentric themes in his perspective, but also in the broader Christian community, where many are disillusioned with liberal theology. Hauerwas, following his Mennonite mentor, John Howard Yoder, refuses to accept any definition of properly formed cultural reality that is not grounded directly in the redemptive ministry of Jesus. The way of Jesus, he argues, is the exclusive normative reference point for the moral life. This means that the kingdom of Jesus Christ embodies economic, political, and social norms that are so antithetical to the patterns of collective life in the larger human culture that Christians are required, in effect, to create an alternative culture. Thus, the Anabaptist-type call for the formation of a kingdom community living in separation from the practices of the larger human community, especially those practices that are closely aligned with the political assumptions of secular thought. This is a powerful perspective from which I have learned much. It certainly exposes the confusions that can result from a simple-minded application of H. Richard Niebuhr's categories. At first glance, one might be inclined, for example, to treat the Amish as a clear example of Christ against culture convictions. But one can plausibly argue that the Amish might be better thought of as creating an alternative culture. They certainly don't reject farming. Rather, they transform the typical patterns of farming. Nor do they reject technology as such, insisting instead on alternative technologies. The horse-drawn buggy is as much a piece of transportation technology as an SUV. Furthermore, the present-day Anabaptists and their fellow pilgrims are right to call us to account for the ways in which we often identify discipleship with specific political programs and ideologies. The church's record in aligning itself with political power and in freely giving its blessing to various military campaigns is not a noble one. For all of that, though, I'm not ready to concede that the solution for Christian disciples is to abandon all efforts to employ the political means available to us as Christians as a way of pursuing goals. Nor am I convinced that a thoroughgoing pacifism is mandated for Christian disciples. I won't argue these matters here, but I can at least point out that while Nestle Nubigen, who was, as I've already noted, one of the leading thinkers in shaping the call for a post-Christendom Christian witness in the West, that Nubigen refused simply to reject everything that was associated with the Constantinian arrangement. Quote, "Much has been written," he observed, "about the harm done to the cause of the gospel when Constantine accepted baptism. And it's not difficult to expatiate on this theme. But could any other choice have been made? The Constantinian arrangement emerged," Nubigen argued, "in a time of spiritual crisis in which the larger culture and the people, he said, turned to the church as the one society that could hold a disintegrating world together." "What should the church have said in response?" asked Nubigen. "Should it simply have," and I'm quoting him here, "refused the appeal and washed its hands of responsibility for the political order?" It's not to ignore the ways in which Christians, as he put it, fell into the temptation of worldly power. But do we really think that the cause of the gospel would have been better served, quote, "if the church had refused all political responsibility, if there had never been a Christian Europe?" In Nubigen's own answer, I find it hard to think so. Note that in making that observation, Nubigen is referring specifically to the Christian acceptance of political responsibility in the larger culture. I'm convinced, however, that his point can plausibly be extended to a broader cultural engagement. H. Richard Niebuhr certainly had a larger canvas in mind when he offered his understanding of the cultural arena. Culture, he insisted, and this is his beginning of a definition, it is the artificial secondary environment which man superimposes on the natural. It comprises language, habits, ideas, beliefs, customs, social organization, inherited artifacts, technical processes, and values. End quote. Once we expand our attention to this broader canvas, we move beyond simply arguing about such matters as violence and nonviolence, the nature of policy formation, and the like. One of the items that Niebuhr includes in his depiction of culture, as I've just quoted it, is language. Fundamental to our shared life as human beings is our capacity for communicating with each other in the larger human community by a shared vocabulary. How then do we view our patterns of communication with each other in the larger human community from a faith perspective? At one point in Resident Aliens, a 1989 book co-authored by Stanley Hauerwas and Will Willimon, Hauerwas addressed the question of a common moral vocabulary in the public arena, and he did so in a way that suggested that he was willing to follow his countercultural convictions to the point of questioning whether Christians can even legitimately use words like justice and peace in addressing the issues of public policy. The assumption that Christians can assume a common core of meaning that we share with non-Christians when we employ such language, Hauerwas insisted, is fundamentally misguided. We don't really mean the same things by these terms. These terms can have no meaning for believers, he argued. This is his phrase, apart from the life and death of Jesus of Nazareth. It's only the biblical witness to Jesus' ministry that, he says, gives content to our faith, judges any institutional embodiment of our faith, and teaches us to be suspicious of any political slogan that does not need God to make itself credible. This denial of a shared public discourse has not been received well by those of us who are convinced that it's important. This is an important time for the Christian community to explore new strategies for working for the common good. Princeton's retired theologian Max Stackhouse spelled out the alternative case well in insisting that, I'm going to quote him for a little while here, that human life at its root is a very profound logos rooted in theos, which is what makes it possible for Jews, Christians, Hindus, Muslims, and humanists to talk reasonably with one another and to live together in a society governed by a modicum of justice. Further, we can, in some measure, talk across boundaries and more or less discern what is valid and not valid in what others say. And we expect others to understand us and to challenge us when we do not make sense, end quote. And James Gustafson has criticized Hauerwas directly, accusing him of succumbing to what Gustafson describes as the sectarian temptation, a pattern of thinking that fails to acknowledge a robust theology of creation. Interestingly, though, some of Hauerwas's friends have accused him of not being sectarian enough. Robert W. Brimlow, for example, tells us that while he considers much of what Hauerwas says on these matters to be, as he put it, correct and containing blessed insights, he still worries that Hauerwas fails to stick consistently to his principles. Brimlow points to some comments in Hauerwas's writings where Hauerwas seems to allow for some sort of translation of particularistic Christian language into terms that make sense to non-Christians. These concessions, argues Brimlow, are ridiculous in the way they blunt the force of Hauerwas's emphasis on radical discipleship. So Brimlow calls Hauerwas to return to an uncompromising insistence that Christians are, and these are his words, called to the margins, we're called to be weak and separate, and to view ourselves as such. We must therefore turn our back on all that is incompatible with the gospel. And for Brimlow, this means that Christians must pursue a way of life that draws inspiration from the ghetto patterns of life formed by Hasidic Jews, even to the point of having Christians live in close proximity to one another. Sounds Amish to me. In order to create an alternative community that includes, for example, forming its own economic and educational institutions, living in accordance with its own rhythms of worship and work, end quote. Now, those rather polarized responses to Hauerwas, as exemplified by Gustafson's charge that Hauerwas is sectarian, and Brimlow, who wishes that Hauerwas would be more unabashedly sectarian, point us to a spectrum upon which we must all locate our understandings of the Christ and culture relationship. And as we think theologically about these matters, which surely we should, I'm convinced that we must wrestle with what I see as a fundamental and eloquently expressed contention by H. Richard Niebuhr. In the course of explaining what Niebuhr sees as the merits of the Christ-transforming culture option, Niebuhr observes that while sin has seriously damaged the patterns and processes of culture in our fallen world, it has not simply obliterated God's original cultural designs. What has resulted because of sin, he contends, is that, and now this I take to be the fundamental thesis, and I take a powerful thesis in Niebuhr's book, is that our culture is all corrupted order rather than order for corruption. It is perverted good, not evil. It is evil as perversion and not as badness of being. Sin distorts a good order. It doesn't destroy it. That theological issue was precisely what was at stake in an observation that John Howard Yoder made in one of our, his and my, public debates during the 1970s. After each of us had made a presentation one evening at a Mennonite college campus, a member of the audience asked Yoder to state what he saw as the most basic issue on which the two of us disagreed. Yoder's answer, "On questions of culture, Mao wants to say fallen but created, and I want to say created but fallen." For Yoder, that question about the degree to which God's original intentions for human culture are still on display under fallen conditions was at the heart of the ongoing difference between an Anabaptist perspective and those traditions, the Reformed and Catholic systems loom large in this respect, those traditions which see much that is positive at work in present-day cultural formation beyond the redeemed community. And he was right. The issues at stake are extremely important, and they show up in discussions that are somewhat removed from explorations that focus explicitly on theological perspectives on culture as such. David Teedy, the former president of Luther Seminary, once made a memorable observation in a devotional that he gave to a group of theological administrators. "The crude and even blasphemous language of the streets," Teedy said, "often contains theological meanings that the speakers are oblivious to." His two examples were, "What in the hell is going on?" and "What in heaven's name is happening?" Those two expressions, Teedy said, get at important spiritual realities. There's a lot of hellish stuff going on in the world, but we can also on occasion discern things that draw even unwittingly upon heavenly resources. I offer a case in point here. After several decades of working in Hollywood's entertainment industry, Monica Gannis joined the evangelical faculty at Azusa Pacific University, where she teaches in the area of theater, film, and communication studies. Her 2010 book, titled Under the Influence, California's Intoxicating Spiritual and Cultural Impact on America, provides a wealth of illuminating cultural information and perspective, both historical and contemporary, including some wonderful personal anecdotes. Her mother was queen for a day on that old program, and she talks a lot about that. It's great. And best of all, she deals with these matters out of strongly stated Christian convictions, with many theological and missiological insights. Ghana sets the stage for her discussion with a clear distinction between, to use Titi's words, the hellish and the heavenly. On the one hand, she says there is what she calls the delusional and damaging effects of California as a contrived religion. But there's also, beneath all the damage, she says, the promise of California, the created religion. And at work in all of the sordid patterns of California life, she's focusing mainly on Southern California because you get a lot of different California cultures in the middle regions and Northern California. But anyway, all of the sordid patterns of California life, she says, At work, there are what she calls eternal instincts and longings that point to redemptive possibilities. These created yearnings can, if properly redirected, help us, she says, to turn our attention to real environment, real community, real relationships, and real policies. Without that redirecting, though, she says, we'll find ourselves in a trance-like state that anesthetizes us to actual human experience, relationship, environment, and, she says, I fear, to the true God. I learned much from reading Gonis's book, but I also began to experience a little discomfort early on in her discussion when she employed the empire image as set forth in Walter Brueggemann's stark contrast between Christ's kingdom and our human-created empires. Here's her summary of that Brueggemannian contrast. She writes, "The kingdom is based on grace, the empire on earnings. The kingdom is freeing, the empire is binding. The kingdom is peaceful, the empire is brutal. The kingdom is authentic, the empire deceitful. The kingdom is forgiving, the empire judgmental. The kingdom is renewing, the empire debilitating. The kingdom is imaginative, the empire predictable. The kingdom is filled with second chances and good news to the poor. The empire is filled with power, greed, and injustice." Now, I have no difficulty with this kind of contrast as such. We do, of course, wrestle. Not so much against flesh and blood in California or in Texas, but against principalities and powers. We run into problems, however, when we simply identify the actual realities of California culture or Texas culture. It's very real flesh and blood with these empire characteristics. Indeed, I see the danger here as closely associated with empire talk as such. Empires range over territories. They take much of their shape and institutional realities. I think it's misleading to think, for example, of California's cultural territory as a part of an empire in that sense. Back in the 1970s, some of my friends in the evangelical activist movement were taken, particularly in our shared opposition to the Vietnam War, with the kind of rhetoric set forth by William Stringfellow, who depicted the United States as the Book of Revelation's sinful Babylon, embodying and promoting what he described as a global way of death, the American way of death being exported around the world. As a parent in those days of a young child just starting school, I found this depiction difficult to reconcile with my son's daily walking route to and from his inner city school. Along the way, there were stop signs and traffic signals, and at one point, a uniformed crossing guard. Our son's school was regularly visited by fire and safety inspectors. All of these were life-promoting gifts. There was much that I wanted to criticize in those days about the American way, and there still is today. But to characterize it simply as a way of death, or as in the more recent rhetoric, an empire that is devoted to what is brutal and deceitful and debilitating, is to fail to recognize the life-affirming gifts that it makes available to us. And this shows up in other areas of contemporary life. For example, when my wife and I have stayed in European hotels, we've often missed the culture, the customer service orientation that strikes me as typical in American hotels, including the Courtyard by Marriott here in Waco. It's nice to be welcomed by a desk clerk and to receive a call from her a few minutes after arriving in one's assigned room, asking whether the room is satisfactory. I have no doubt that the display of American friendliness is mandated by a corporate culture that has made decisions about the profitability of customer satisfaction. But then I'm not asking to be loved, only to have a fairly comfortable stay for a night or two away from home. And the provision of these comforts seem to me to be somewhat removed from the rebellious patterns of empire sinfulness. God's original designs for the creation, in my experience, frequently show up then in both hotel lobbies and school crossing zones. And I must add, in this context, in movie theaters. Monica Gannis knows much about the film industry, and her book offers many insights on that important area of California culture. But there are times when I fear that she is too captivated by the notion that somehow the film industry simply is in the empire. Here, for example, is Gannis describing the way we can be tempted to see ourselves as she puts it, omniscient and omnipresent while we're watching a film. And I'm quoting a long paragraph here. Sitting in the hushed darkness of the film cathedral, enjoying our sacramental popcorn, for which we've paid too high a price, congregants gaze at the altar of the screen and are given plot information that many characters in the movie do not know and cannot control. We piece together the story we are told, traveling from location to location, with or without all the characters, filling in the narrative gaps. And thus it begins to feel as though we ourselves are telling the story. It seems to be our own idea, and thus difficult to refute for the time being, whether or not it aligns with our general beliefs. End quote. All of this is enhanced, she says, by the use of what she describes as powerful enough technologies to ensure the success of this mystical enterprise. Special effects and the likes can invite us into an intimacy with characters who become, she observes, larger than life, thereby lending a supernatural component to the action and serve to making the narrative at least as vital as the one we're hearing at church. Now, I have at least two concerns about this kind of depiction. One is that while making a film or watching one, that can indeed be an occasion for grasping at omniscience and omnipotence, and thus yet one more way of taking up the tempter's challenge that we can be like God. But while I do think it can be that, I don't think it must be that. Films can serve to cultivate, for example, a very human empathy for the hopes and fears of other human beings. They can also sensitize us to seeing plot patterns and connections that the characters in the film themselves cannot see. And seeing them larger than life can be a way of alerting us to narrative unities in a world that often seems to foster fragmented plot lines. More importantly for me, though, is my uneasiness with Gannis' use of church-going imagery. Picture of the theater as a film cathedral that dispenses sacramental popcorn, with congregants gazing at the altar of the screen, and all of this in the service of a mystical enterprise. My theological suspicion about this way of viewing things is that when we see the church as embodying a culture that functions primarily as a radical alternative to the culture beyond the boundaries of the church, we tend then to see the larger patterns of culture as kind of perverse churchly things. This results in a kind of reductionism that insensitizes us to the good things that happen in other spheres of cultural interaction. My worry here was captured nicely by Mark Galley in a Books and Culture review, and this campus is a good place to talk about a football analogy. Mark Galley in a Books and Culture review essay dealing with writers who are fond of depicting football games and other major sports events in religious categories, as when the Super Bowl becomes a ritualized event that produces experiences that border on spiritual ecstasy, creating bonding experiences, fostering communal celebrations, calling for physical sacrifice, and so forth. Galley rightly rejects such portrayals of football games as such. Certainly, there are many people, he writes, for whom football has become an idol, such as the nature of the human heart, that desperately wicked thing. But he goes on, it's precisely because many of us experience true religion that we can relax and see a football game for what it is, one of the places where we can often see God's handiwork and love being manifested. I could stop, just tell you, that at the turn of the millennium, Sports Illustrated did a cover story, "Does God Care Who Wins the Super Bowl?" And I was interviewed for it. More people commented on seeing my name in Sports Illustrated than anything else I've ever done. And I was asked, "Does God care?" And I said, "Yeah, I think God is really interested in football. And I think God likes a good game. And I think that God, when a 40-yard pass, is like one the other day, caught with one hand. I mean, just amazing. I think God says, what? That's good. That's one of the reasons why I created the world, for things like that to happen." But they also interviewed the late Reggie White, who was, many of you know, a Pentecostal minister. And I'm glad we did not meet, because we really disagree with each other. He said, "God loves winners and hates losers. And if you want to please God at the Super Bowl, you win at all costs, you know." I had a nice little side story to that. Was about praying at sports events. The Sports Illustrator guy talking on the phone said, "What do you think of people who cross themselves or bow their knee, you know, T-bowing?" That wasn't the word then, but that's what he had in mind. And he said, "Doesn't the Bible say someplace that you should pray, do your praying in a closet and not in public?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Where is that?" He said, I have a Bible here. By the way, he said, "I stayed in a hotel last night, and I took the Gideon Bible with me. Do you think that's ethical?" And I said, I will gladly increase my contribution to the Gideons this year, so don't feel guilty about it." When I told the Gideons that, they actually asked me to write that up for one of their but anyway, football game. When God's handiwork and love are being manifested in a football game, we can be grateful for amazing 80-yard runs, for spectacular pass receptions, and for a coach's wise use of timeouts in the final minutes of the game. The old anti-Freudian remark that sometimes a cigar is just a cigar has its parallel here. Sometimes a football game is just a football game. And sometimes eating popcorn at a good movie is just eating popcorn at a good movie. That's not to deny, of course, that there can very well be, and often is, bad football games and bad popcorn and bad movies. And there are indeed cases where football and popcorn and movies can function in obvious ways as empire, because they have become instruments of deceit and destruction. But sometimes the badness is of a less cosmic sort. The game is played poorly by both teams, or the popcorn is stale or too salty, or the film's special effects render certain key scenes ineffective. Much the same holds for other areas of cultural interaction. It's what goes on, for example, when we take the worst of Hollywood and use it to declare its immediate surroundings to be a part of a rebellious empire. In many aspects of its life, however, Southern California, along with New York City's Harlem District and the neighborhoods of Waco, Texas, are simply regions where many very ordinary things happen on a daily basis. People search for parking spaces. Couples get married. Writers struggle with finding just the right opening paragraph for essays and books. And parents are pleased when their teenage daughters get summer jobs selling popcorn in a local movie complex. Sometimes, too, often in fact, in our sinful world, much of this goes bad, as when people fight in parking lots, or when the caterer messes up the food for the wedding reception, or the writer decides to get the reader's attention with a lurid description, or the teenager falls in with the wrong crowd at her summer job selling popcorn. And of course, there are times when a very large segment of culture goes horribly bad. When that happens, that which is associated with empire imagery can serve to provide some explanatory power. To look for those signs of utter corruption is important, even obligatory, for Christians. But so are the efforts to discern the signs of promise. So my urging is for Christians to pay close attention to the distinction between the heavenly and the hellish in the larger culture. This means, in turn, that we must cultivate the tools of cultural discernment. And for those of us who are called to provide leadership in Christian communities, these tools must be refined by exegetical sensitivities. But in all of that, it's important to remind ourselves that the Creator, to use a wonderful hymn line that I chose for a title of one of my books, shines in all that's fair. This is where I find Abraham Kuyper's theology so helpful. Common grace, for Kuyper, is a non-salvific manifestation of divine favor toward the fallen creation. In good part, it is a restraining grace, a leash on sinfulness that keeps human beings from being as bad as they could be. But it also works positively in unredeemed life. Kuyper sees common grace at work in a positive manner. Wonderful line from Kuyper. Wherever civic virtue, a sense of domesticity, natural love, the practice of human virtue, the improvement of the public conscience, integrity, mutual loyalty among people, and a feeling for piety leavens life. In all of these things, God's common grace is at work. The danger of an empire approach to the study of what goes on routinely in California, Texas, or any other complex cultural context is that it might keep us from noticing those very signs of common grace. To look for the hellishness, the distortions of God's purposes for human flourishing is important. But so is the effort to discern the signs of the heavenly in our culture, even when they show up in surprising places. Thank you.